Today's episode will touch on sensitive topics, such as birth trauma and child death. So if you are sensitive to these topics, please listen at your own discretion.
What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hello and welcome to our very first episode of Art Muse, a podcast that aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret well-known works of art by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. While these women's faces are familiar to viewers around the world, their identities have been largely forgotten. Each episode will focus our attention on the female muse, sharing their important lives and legacy. Together, we will appreciate these works of art from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. In doing so, I hope to shift our notion of the muse from a passive participant to the driving force of inspiration behind these works of art. Is the muse in actuality just as, if not more important than the artists themselves? Season 1 of Art Muse looks at 10 different female muses from notable works of art and shares their personal stories. And I'm your host, Grace Anna. Today, I share with you the story of arguably the world's most famous face, the Mona Lisa. Thousands of viewers pour into the Louvre every day to catch a glimpse of Mona Lisa's enigmatic smile, her eyes that follow your every move, and her hands that seem to carry all the mysteries of this world. While her image is universally recognizable, the identity of the woman in Leonardo da Vinci's celebrated portrait has, for the most part, been left out of the conversation. Who was the Mona Lisa? Who was the woman with the world's most mysterious smile? And why is she smiling? Yes, the Mona Lisa is a portrait of a real woman from history. Listeners, I'd like to introduce you to Lisa Gherardini, a tried and true Florentine noblewoman who lived her life during the peak of the Italian Renaissance. Her life story includes romance, painful loss, scandal, mystery, and political upheaval. But more than anything else, it is the story of a convivial, courageous, and independent woman who mothered children, weathered immense losses, and lived her life out with nobility and honor. I want to start by debunking the many other theories, some bordering on the ridiculous, on the identity of the Mona Lisa. These theories have been circulating for a long time, and you may very well have come across them yourself. No, the Mona Lisa is not a portrait of Leonardo in drag. And no, the Mona Lisa is not a portrait of Leonardo's assistant and possibly lover, Salai. We will speak to the number of credible primary sources attesting to the Mona Lisa being a portrait of Lisa Gherardini later on. For now, it's important to note that while skeptics poked holes in surviving evidence for years, in 2005, an annotated text discovered at the University of Heidelberg in Germany proved Lisa Gherardini's identity as the Mona Lisa indisputable. Lisa was born into a long legacy of the Gherardini bloodline, an important aristocratic Tuscan family with origins in the Chianti region dating back to antiquity. The family's primary source of income was from various farms that produced wine, wheat, olive oil, and raised livestock. Lisa's grandfather, Noldo di Antonio Gherardini, was the first of her lineage to move from Chianti to the city of Florence, where Lisa's father, Anton Maria, was born. It's worth taking a step back and learning a bit about Anton Maria, as it will help us better understand Lisa. Anton Maria lived in Florence, but continued to live off the Gherardini farm income, owning and renting approximately 6 farms in the Chianti region as his primary occupation.
As a member of an important aristocratic family, he would have been raised to be the quintessential Renaissance gentleman. Despite his important lineage, Anton Maria must have understood that an advantageous marriage would be his best foot forward to secure himself, both financially and socially. And with his notable family name, he would have made a promising marriage prospect. At the age of 21, Anton Maria made just this move and married Lisa Di Giovanni Filippo Di Carducci, the daughter of a well-established Florentine family. Tragically, soon after they wed, Lisa died in childbirth along with their firstborn, leaving behind a widowed and grieving Anton Maria. A few years later, Anton Maria got himself back on the market and managed to secure himself a second favorable marriage, this time to Caterina Rucellai from a well-to-do family successful in the fabric industry. We can imagine Anton Maria took this as a second lease on life and had high prospects for his future. Unfortunately, Caterina also died a few years later in childbirth, once again leaving Anton Maria a childless widow who probably at this point cursed his rotten luck. In a strange twist of fate, Caterina's younger sister, who was born just after Caterina's death, would also die in childbirth many years later, leaving behind her own widowed husband, Francesco del Giocondo. Lisa Gherardini would marry Francesco shortly after his first wife's death. Anton Maria and Lisa's future husband would share the tragedy of losing a wife of the Rucellai family. And had it not been for both of the Rucellai sisters' deaths, our Lisa and the beloved Mona Lisa portrait may have never existed. Anton Maria, at the age of 32 and at the upper limit of desirability for a husband, once again put himself back on the market and managed to secure his third marriage, this time to the much younger Lucrezia del Caccia, of another aristocratic family from Chianti. 3 years later, Lucrezia became pregnant. Anton Maria must have been holding his breath, anxious that the same ill fate may fall upon him for a third time. Fortunately, on June 15, 1479, Lucrezia safely gave birth to a healthy baby girl and Anton Maria's firstborn, Lisa Camilla Gherardini. We can imagine how much this baby meant to Anton Maria after all the devastation he had experienced. Soon after her birth, Lisa would have been cleaned and swaddled and taken immediately to the baptistry of St. John to be baptized. We can picture Anton Maria proudly marching across the Ponte Vecchio with his newborn baby girl. Along the way, he would have passed Via Por Santa Maria, where 14-year-old Francesco del Giocondo may have watched from outside his family's fabric shop, not knowing that this baby would someday become his wife. The record of Lisa's baptism still remains today in city records. Her birth would have been celebrated for weeks, and Anton Maria must have felt immense joy and pride. Yet despite the celebration, Anton Maria had not escaped his streak of bad luck. By the time Lisa was born, the Gherardini family had lost much of its influence. To make matters worse, just before Lisa's birth, many of Anton Maria's properties were burned and destroyed in a battle between Pope Sixtus IV and Lorenzo de' Medici. The Chianti region was pillaged and suffered mass destruction. In an act of defiance, Anton Maria wrote on his tax statement of that year, "For the love of war, I have no income. Our houses have been burned, our possessions smashed, and our workers and livestock lost." As Anton Maria's primary source of income came from the Gherardini landholdings in Chianti, this attack took a heavy toll on Anton Maria and his ability to financially support himself and his family. When Lisa was born, Anton Maria was renting a home in an old and long-closed wool workshop on Via Squaza, a squalid and decrepit street. Amidst his financial struggles, Anton Maria would have been extra humiliated by his inability to properly plan for Lisa's eventual dowry, a disgrace for a man carrying a noble Florentine name. Dowries at the time were incredibly important, and the surest way to secure a future, not only for one's daughter, but for one's family name. Anton Maria, who finally had a child of his own, would have known early on that it would take a miracle to secure his daughter a prosperous marriage. Despite the financial troubles, Lisa's childhood wouldn't have been all that grim. At the age of 4, Lisa became a big sister, and eventually the eldest of 7 children. With the help of Lisa's maternal grandparents, the Delcaccias, the family moved from the filthy street of Lisa's beginnings to a rental on Via dei Pepi, just around the corner from her grandparents. Also just steps away lived Ser Piero da Vinci, the father of the one and only Leonardo da Vinci, who would, of course, one day paint Lisa's famous portrait. While Lisa would have undoubtedly been expected to help her mother with housework and caring for her younger siblings, as Anton Maria was in no position to afford outside help, we can imagine that she overall lived a happy childhood. Lisa and her family spent the hot Tuscan summers in one of Anton Maria's properties named Ca di Pessa in Poggio, a small village south of the city. While her education would have been somewhat limited due to Anton Maria's strained financial standings, she still would have learned to read and write, mastered simple arithmetic, and engaged in poetry, singing, and the mastery of a musical instrument. It is likely that she learned needlework and embroidery, and her mother would have coached her in female decorum. Even with her education and prim manners, Lisa's future largely depended on her father's ability to find her a suitable and dependable husband, who would be able to adequately provide for her. With no dowry, this must have seemed an impossible task. And yet, Lisa, maybe with the allure of her immortalized smile, defied all odds and married one of Florence's most successful young businessmen. Listeners, let me formally introduce you to Francesco Del Giocondo. The Del Giocondo family were successful silk makers, running one of Florence's most prestigious fabric workshops. Unlike the Gherardinis, whose aristocratic status could be traced back for centuries, the Del Giocondo family was known as Nuove Gente, translating as new people, and what we today would call new money. It was Francesco's great-grandfather, Jacopo di Bartolomeo, who changed the course for his family. A man of humble beginnings, Jacopo ran an artisan shop, crafting many of Florence's essential commodities, like wine barrels. Legend has it that Jacopo never stopped smiling and joking, earning him the nickname Giocondo, or the Happy One, a name which passed down to future generations. Jacopo managed to amass a significant sum of money. His sons inherited Jacopo's wealth and decided to join the Silk Guild, eventually founding their own fabric trading company. Francesco's father, Bartolomeo, continued to grow the family business into a successful enterprise. By 1458, the family had 2 shops by the Ponte Vecchio, with customers from Florence and beyond, even selling to the Grand Turk. Francesco Del Giocondo was born on March 19, 1465. His father trained Francesco with his brothers in the fabric workshop in order to grow the Del Giocondo business. When his father died in 1484, his portion of the business was passed on to 19-year-old Francesco, despite Francesco being the youngest son. We can only imagine the kind of ambition that young Francesco must have shown to earn his father's trust above his older brothers. By this point, the Del Giocondo family had 3 workshops, which sold silk and other fabrics such as satin and velvet. The business attracted the most important patrons of Florence, including the Medicis and Strozzis. A natural businessman, Francesco continued to expand the business, and by 1490, only a small fraction of the sales were local. Along with his brothers, Francesco set up a trading company in Lyon, France. We can imagine Francesco, the typical Florentine businessman, both innovative and relentless in his practice. With a history of questionable business ethics, Giuseppe Pallanti, the leading scholar on Lisa Gherardini, paints a picture of Francesco as, quote, bold and confident, intolerant of rules and those who enforce them, with a business sense and lack of scruples that often bordered on illegality. Despite his quarrelsome nature, Francesco would have been a highly desirable potential husband. And at the age of 26, he arranged a marriage with Camilla Rucellai, the younger sister of Anton Maria's late second wife. Camilla, only 16 at the time, was the daughter of a rich and powerful businessman and local patron of the Del Giocondo shops. 2 years after their marriage, Camilla gave birth to a healthy baby boy, Bartolomeo, named after Francesco's father. It must have seemed like smooth sailing for Francesco, who couldn't have been more successful in his business, had married into an important Florentine family, and produced a healthy male offspring. This all came crashing down when just 18 months after Bartolomeo's birth, Camilla tragically died of an unknown infection. Despite his mourning, Francesco, who was approaching 30 and now with a motherless son to care for, knew that his best course of action was to marry again, and quickly. We can imagine Francesco was still quite an appealing marriage prospect, as he was swiftly becoming one of the city's most successful businessmen. And so it is with some mystery that Francesco married the dowryless Lisa, 8 months after Camilla's death. It is not clear how Francesco became acquainted with the Gherardini family. What is more perplexing is why a man of Francesco's stature, even given his somewhat dire situation, would marry a woman without a proper dowry, and whose family was quite clearly under an immense amount of financial strain. At the time of Francesco and Lisa's marriage, dowries were higher in both cost and importance than ever. Most fathers, even from families less well-off than the Gherardinis, started investment funds at the Monte del Doti as soon as their daughters were born. But we know that Anton Maria's financial strain prevented him from doing this. As one Renaissance scholar stated, quote, a marriage without a dowry seemed more blameworthy than a union unblessed by the church. It wouldn't have been unreasonable for Anton Maria to have written off the possibility that his firstborn would ever be able to find a suitable partner. And yet, he somehow secures Lisa's marriage to one of Florence's most prestigious men. The documentation still exists recording the marital agreement that Francesco and Anton Maria eventually made in place of a dowry. On March 5, 1495, Anton Maria signed over San Silvestro, the largest of the Gherardini family farms, to Francesco. The farm was valued at 400 florins, with the furniture adding an additional 170 florins. To give us some perspective, the average dowry from an affluent family in Florence at that time was about 10 times that value. Moreover, Francesco already owned two estates outside of Florence and clearly had no strong need for more countryside properties. But Francesco accepts the farm in lieu of a dowry and remains in ownership of it for the rest of his life. As we will later see, Francesco actually returned the farm back to Lisa in his will, another testament that the dowry played little part in Francesco's decision to marry Lisa. With the dowry off the table, we have to ask ourselves, why did Francesco marry Lisa? The reasons behind Francesco's decision to marry Lisa are largely up to conjecture. As a wealthy 30-year-old merchant with a successful business, Francesco didn't necessarily need the money a dowry typically provided. Could he have been so desperate for someone to mother his newborn baby and continue to grow his family that he was willing to forego a dowry? Could his situation have made him this less appealing to other suitable matches that he had to settle for what he could find? Or did Francesco catch a glimpse of the 16-year-old Lisa's striking beauty? Lisa was known to be exceptionally beautiful, and at 14 years his younger, his attraction may have won him over. Could they have fallen in love? A love strong enough for Francesco to overlook Lisa's inability to provide a dowry? The most convincing theory to me is though Lisa could not offer much in the dowry department, she could offer ties to ancient aristocracy, something that the Del Giocondo family lacked. It is the classic story of new money meets old money, or more accurately, old Florentine legacy. Marrying a woman of the Gherardini family could have lifted the Del Giocondo family to a higher status and offered his lineage noble blood. Lisa's ties to a pedigree name may have meant way more to the self-sufficient Francesco than any dowry ever would. And so, Lisa Gherardini married Francesco Del Giocondo on March 5, 1495. Lisa was just 16 years old, and Francesco 30. While by today's standards this would raise reasonable alarm, at the time women often married as soon as they began menstruating, as early as 15 or 16, whereas men more typically got married in their late 20s. The marriage would have been sealed with a dowry transition, in this case Anton Maria handing over the San Silvestro farm, and a public wedding the day after. We can picture the young and beautiful Lisa, with a life now full of promise, parading in her gown down the streets of her city. Her father and Francesco would have attracted the attention of the Florentine elite, and on her special day, she likely had some of the city's most important persons in attendance. She may have even given her new husband, and those special enough to witness, a glimpse of her alluring smile, as if to say, despite all odds, I did it. After the wedding, Lisa moved from her family home to the Del Giocondo household, sharing the house with Francesco's brothers, sisters, and elderly mother. We can only imagine this would have been a period of intense adjustment as Lisa familiarized herself with her new home and family. Lisa also would have been thrust into motherhood, caring for Francesco's son Bartolomeo. Not only would Lisa take in Bartolomeo as her own, she herself became pregnant shortly after the wedding. If this story has taught us nothing else, it is how immensely risky it was to birth a child in 15th century Italy. In fact, one in four women died in childbirth. With her first child on the way, Lisa may have prayed for a safe delivery for both herself and her future child. She would have been doted upon and well taken care of as they all held their breath. And it is with great pleasure that I relay that Lisa gave birth to a healthy baby boy, Piero Zanobi Del Giocondo. His birth would have been celebrated for weeks, a celebration of both life and survival, and of Francesco's second male heir, who would join Bartolomeo as a half-brother. And Lisa would have been celebrating most of all, her first child of her own born safely into this world. Just a year later, in 1497, Lisa gave birth to her second child, this time a little girl named Piera. Unfortunately, at just 2 years old, little Piera died of unknown causes. This would have been an unimaginable loss for Lisa, who buried her daughter in the family vault at the Santa Maria Novella. To intensify things, as Lisa was grieving the death of Piera, she was also navigating another pregnancy. She gave birth to her third child, Camilla, just 2 months after Piera's death. This must have been an immensely intense and confusing time for Lisa, who was mourning Piera while simultaneously celebrating the birth of Camilla. Perhaps Lisa felt that Piera's spirit lived on in Camilla's, that with death came life, and it may have amplified her attachment to Camilla. As we will later see, Camilla's life would also come to a tragic end. But for now, the birth of Camilla must have been a blessing in what we can only imagine was an otherwise dark time. Over the next 4 years, Lisa birthed two more children, Marietta and Andrea. You may be thinking, that's a lot of children to birth in a relatively short amount of time. I certainly was. While Lisa gave birth to each of her children, women of her status didn't breastfeed their children, instead employing wet nurses for milk. This not only tempered the strain of childbearing, but would have made women ready for their next pregnancy far quicker. As a mother, Lisa's life would have revolved around her children. She was responsible for their development and education, taking charge of what the children learned, such as reading, writing, arithmetic, music, and the likes. As the governess of the house, she would have directed all affairs of domestic life, overseeing servants, planning meals, ordering household supplies, and keeping household inventory. She would have equally important social obligations, hosting important guests at household dinners and gatherings. By all accounts, Francesco seemed to have provided Lisa with a high-quality life. As the wife of an important fabrics manufacturer, Lisa would have been dressed in elegant garments made of the finest of cloths. With the birth of each of her children, Lisa was likely gifted lavish jewelry. She would have spent time in Francesco's beautiful estates, like the one on Montughi Hill, which had a breathtaking view of Florence. Lisa and Francesco's marriage seemed to be particularly affectionate. Francesco went out of his way to care for Lisa and her family, at times lending Anton Maria money and providing for Lisa's siblings. Francesco also eventually built Lisa and their growing family a palazzo of their own, separate from the Del Giocondo household. Despite what we know of Francesco's shark-like nature, he seemed to have a particular soft spot for Lisa, who we can imagine he really loved. And what better way to show one's love than to commission a portrait of your beloved? How Francesco came in contact with Leonardo da Vinci, arguably the leading artist of the time, is another perplexing mystery. How did Francesco manage to commission a work when Leonardo turned away proposal after proposal from the most important institutions and patrons? We must consider how remarkable it is that Leonardo, who only produced about 20 surviving paintings, would choose to paint the portrait of a relatively unknown Florentine woman. How did Lisa become the subject of Leonardo's most prized masterpiece? Da Vinci's ties to Lisa and Francesco seem largely to do with fate and circumstance. To start, the home that Anton Maria moved his family to, with the aid of Lisa's maternal grandparents, was just a stone throw away from Ser Piero da Vinci, Leonardo's father. This means that Ser Piero very likely became acquainted with Anton Maria and would have witnessed Lisa's maturation into womanhood. We have to wonder, could Leonardo have caught a glimpse of Lisa on one of his visits to his father? Would he have known that this girl would one day become the subject of his most renowned work of art? The second and surest means of connection between Francesco and Leonardo was due to both of their associations with the Church of Santissima Annunziata. At the start of the 1500s, just before Leonardo began the portrait, Francesco, Leonardo, and his father, Ser Piero, were all involved with the church. Ser Piero provided legal advice and was the monastery's notary for over 30 years. Francesco lent the monastery money, and Leonardo was commissioned to paint the church's most important altarpiece. In return for his work, the church provided Leonardo with accommodation in the monastery, who lived there from 1500 to 1501. We know that Francesco and Ser Piera worked directly together on a few occasions from surviving records. Francesco provided silk and fabrics for the church altars. And as Francesco was known to be the argumentative type, these dealings often resulted in contention. Just a year before the portrait was commissioned, Ser Piero played peacemaker for a financial dispute between the priests and Francesco. Might Ser Piero have introduced Francesco to his son, who was working on the church's altarpiece at the time? Might they have watched Leonardo as he worked, and together discussed his plans for the commission? Might Francesco have mentioned his beloved wife, his Lisa, to Leonardo in this meeting? Or did Leonardo meet Lisa himself at the church? There are records of Lisa visiting Santissima Annunziata on a regular basis during this time. Lisa had a close relationship with a monk named Valerio and tended to him during his illness and eventual death. There is even a record of Lisa lending the monk dishware, which was returned to her after his passing. Could Lisa and Leonardo's paths have crossed as Lisa went to care for the monk and Leonardo chipped away at the commission? Might Leonardo have been taken by her beauty, by her eyes, by her smile? While the purpose of this episode is to elevate Lisa's story, I do feel it's important to give some brief context surrounding Leonardo during this time. This will help us better understand the circumstances under which Leonardo began his portrait of Lisa, and why he may have accepted Francesco's commission. In 1499, Leonardo returned to Florence after having spent 17 years in Milan. Leonardo did not leave Milan under the jolliest of circumstances. Duke Sforza, the Duke of Milan and Leonardo's greatest patron, was overthrown by the French king Charles VIII and paraded around France in a cage to later be imprisoned in a dungeon. Leonardo fled Milan for refuge in Florence. Forced to leave his life in Milan behind, we can assume that Leonardo felt quite defeated. This would have been amplified by the fact that Leonardo was nearing 50, with quite a few failed ventures under his belt. While his Last Supper mural was as revered then as it is today, it immediately began to fade. This was due to Leonardo's disastrous decision to experiment with what materials he used in the fresco. Leonardo also had plans to build the largest equestrian statue in the world, but only got as far as producing a clay model when the bronze meant for the sculpture was instead used to forge cannons in defense against the French. It is alleged that Leonardo's clay model was used for archery practice, and even that was soon after destroyed. With a tail between his legs, Leonardo must have been seriously considering his life's work and legacy. At the same time, Francesco was also evidently considering his legacy, but under very different terms. In the same year he commissioned Lisa's portrait, Francesco registered all of his assets under his children's name. A month later, Francesco bought the palazzo that he and Lisa could call their own. It seems fitting that Francesco would commission a portrait of Lisa as he reflected on his legacy. The portrait was a way to honor Lisa as his beloved wife and the strong mother of his children, and to immortalize her beauty for generations to come. With both Francesco and Leonardo's circumstances in mind, we can better imagine how the arrangement for Lisa's portrait came about. Francesco, who had amassed great wealth and was in the midst of planning for his family's future, would have had the money and motivation to acquire a portrait of his wife by a famous hand. He may have witnessed Leonardo working at Santissima Annunziata and become determined to own a work of his own. Ser Piero, concerned for Leonardo, might have encouraged his son's collaboration with a successful man like Francesco, whom he had known in business intimately. And Leonardo, feeling the weight of failure after his time in Milan, and needing both money and artistic inspiration, may have felt a renewed sense of purpose as Lisa greeted him with her smile. As fate would have it, Ser Piero passed away just a year after Leonardo began the painting. And so, it was quite fortuitous that Francesco, Leonardo, Ser Piero, and Lisa's paths crossed at this specific point in all of their respective lives. Leonardo began painting his famous portrait of Lisa Gherardini in 1503. Lisa, at the age of 24, was already a mother of five and an elegant Florentine lady. How did Lisa feel about having her portrait made by one of the most famous artists of her time? Was Lisa nervous, excited, anxious? Leonardo would have begun by drawing Lisa, asking her to model for him in various ways. How did Leonardo ask Lisa to pose? Would she have been dressed in the finest of fabrics? Might they have begun to form a friendship or special connection during these beginning stages? While we may never know the answer to these questions, we do have some insight on what the experience may have been like from Lisa's contemporary, Giorgio Vasari, who wrote of Lisa in his famous work, Lives of the Most Excellent Italian Architects, Painters, and Sculptors. In Vasari's words, "Since Mona Lisa was very beautiful, he, Leonardo, always retained, while painting her portrait, persons to play or sing, and jesters who continuously made her cheerful, in order to take away that melancholy that painters often give to their portraits that they make." While we cannot say with certainty that Leonardo hired performers to keep Lisa entertained during her sittings, as Vasari was somewhat notorious for embellishments, the idea is thrilling. Imagine Lisa sitting in Leonardo's studio, surrounded by jesters and players, smiling as she experienced pure amusement and joy. We also know from Vasari that Leonardo, infamous for his inability to finish his works, struggled to complete Lisa's portrait. As Vasari wrote, quote, "Leonardo undertook to make for Francesco del Giocondo the portrait of Mona Lisa, his wife, and after struggling with it for 4 years, he left it unfinished." While the bulk of the painting was done in Florence from 1503 to 1506, Leonardo took the unfinished portrait with him to Milan, and then to Rome, and eventually France, where the painting remained with Leonardo until he died in 1519, 13 years later. While the fact that it was unfinished was inevitably the main reason that Leonardo never turned over the work to Francesco, we have to ask, was there something about Lisa's portrait that Leonardo could not part with? What kept Leonardo so fixated on the portrait? And how did Lisa feel in 1506, when Leonardo left Florence with her anticipated portrait with no promise of return? After 3 years in the making, it would be hard to not have formed an attachment with the work. How did it feel to cast her eyes on the portrait one last time? We can imagine Lisa's dismay and disappointment, having to part with the portrait she would never call her own. If we assume that Leonardo made changes to the portrait over the 13-year period after his departure from Florence, it begs the question, what did the portrait as Lisa would have known it look like? Our best testament to this introduces another Renaissance legend to our story, Raphael. In 1504, at the age of 21, Raphael moved to Florence to apprentice with Leonardo. During this time, Raphael made a pen-on-paper drawing titled Study for a Young Woman on a Balcony, which most scholars believe to be a sketch of Leonardo's Mona Lisa. Raphael's sketch shows a woman angled at a three-quarter view, with her hands crossed in a similar fashion to the Mona Lisa we know today. But his drawing depicts a woman in a headdress rather than a veil, with far straighter hair than in Leonardo's final version. The two starkest differences, however, are the background and Lisa's expression. Instead of Leonardo's fantastical terrain, Raphael's background shows two columns with a small townscape just beyond. The sitter looks as if she is seated on a balcony, perhaps from a prominent palazzo in the city. If you look closely, you see the remnants of the column and balcony in Leonardo's final version. Leonardo, however, has transformed the background into a luscious and mysterious scenescape. One can really appreciate the progression of Leonardo's imagination in comparing this drawing with the final work. Could this mean that Lisa never got to see Leonardo's breathtaking landscape? Just as Lisa never imagined she would end up in the royal collection of France, she may have also never imagined that her image would be seated in such a brilliant and surreal setting. The other obvious difference is, of course, Lisa's expression. While Leonardo's Mona Lisa smiles mysteriously, looking almost otherworldly, Raphael presents what feels like a real woman. Her lips have not yet quite turned into a smile. Instead, we can feel Lisa's timidness, sweet nature, and humility. In this way, Raphael's drawing grants us an intimacy with Lisa that makes her spirit feel palpable. The intimacy Raphael's drawing provides is strengthened by the fact that during his time in Florence, Raphael actually lived in a palazzo just across the street from Lisa. Raphael very likely would have seen, and maybe even known Lisa himself, not just as the subject of Leonardo's portrait, but as a woman in her own right. Might they have run into each other as Raphael made his way to the studio that housed her portrait? Might Raphael have personally observed Lisa's beauty and charm that Leonardo sought to capture? Raphael's sketch of the Mona Lisa not only gives us a better sense of what Lisa's portrait might have looked like, but of Lisa herself. Comparing Raphael's sketch with today's version of the Mona Lisa makes us consider how both Lisa and her portrait continued to live long lives after their departure from each other. It is almost as if Lisa and her portrait, despite their distance, had parallel transformations. As Lisa continued to mature through age and experience, so did her portrait. Her youth turned with age into wisdom. Her timidness turned to knowingness. And her reticent expression turned into a smile. Thank you so much for listening to part one of episode one on Lisa Gherardini, aka the Mona Lisa. We will finish Lisa's story and together examine the Mona Lisa through Lisa's eyes in part two of this episode. I have included images, resources, and suggestions for further reading on the Art Muse website and Instagram. Art Muse is produced by Kula Production Company. Part one of episode one was written and recorded by me, your host, Grace Anna. Until next time, bye for now.